Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. This episode contains strong language. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, Johnny Barger was my partner. We were policemen together. He's the one who introduced me to Frank Liberto. We used to go there quite often. It was real good friends. Of course, I got to be pretty good friends with Frank myself because he could do you a lot of good in Memphis, especially on the police department.
As we heard once before, this is a recreation of Lloyd Jowers telling Dexter King how it was he came to be friends with a guy named Frank Liberto. As Jowers says, if you were a cop, Liberto could do you a lot of good. And Jowers knew that firsthand because Liberto saved him from being fired when he had been found drunk on the job. Jowers would say in 1993 on ABC Primetime that the reason Liberto was able to bring him into the plot against King was because Jowers owed him.
Liberto done me a large favor, so I owed him a favor.
I called the union hall. I said, it's a matter of life and death. I said, I think these people are planning to kill Dr. King.
The authorities would parade, oh, we found a gun that James Earl Ray bought in Birmingham that killed Dr. King. Except, it wasn't the gun that killed Dr. King.
James Earl Ray was a pawn for the official story.
From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV.
The plan was to get King to the city because they wanted it handled in Memphis where Daddy and them could handle it.
And I have lived with it so long, my children, they scared for me. The Lord told me to not to worry. I've been wanting to tell it all my life.
I'm Bill Klaber, and this is the MLK Tapes. As we just heard, Lloyd Jowers on national TV said that Frank Liberto was able to bring him into the plot to kill King because he owed him a favor. But murder seems a little beyond what Jowers should have owed if all Liberto had done was put in a good word. So what was it? Bill Pepper thinks Liberto might have removed and disposed of a man who Jowers killed because he caught him in bed with Betty Spates. Bill says Betty told him about this, though I couldn't find it on any tape. Of course, the debt may have been something more common, because along with his problem with alcohol, Jowers liked to gamble. Apparently, he owed Liberto, or worse still, Liberto's boss, a pile of money, more money than he could repay. So for the moment, let's accept that as the leverage. But what did Jowers have that Liberto wanted? Here's what Jowers' attorney, Louis Garrison, had to say.
When it came time to get someone to do the assassination, he thought Jowers would be the person would do it, so that's what happened.
So according to Garrison, Frank Liberto picked Jowers because he thought he was the man who could do the job. I have a good opinion of Louis Garrison, but I think he has this piece of the puzzle wrong. I think Liberto picked Jowers because the back door to his grill opened onto a brush-covered yard directly across from the Lorraine Motel. And Liberto, who knew about these things, apparently assured Jowers that the police would not be a problem. Here's what Jowers said about that, again, on ABC.
He said they wouldn't be there. Said they wouldn't be there that night.
Did he say there would be a decoy there?
Yes, sir. Said it would be set up where it looked like someone else done the killing.
So at this point, if we're following the signpost, the plot goes back to a wholesale produce guy who is more than a wholesale produce guy. So who can tell us about Frank Liberto? This is just what Dexter King and Andy Young wanted to know in 1997 when they met with Jowers and Garrison in some motel room out on the highway, the same meeting we listened to in the last episode. And Jowers told them about some woman named Lavada Whitlock Addison, who Frank Liberto liked a lot and who he saw frequently at the end of the day. Again, for clarity, we are recreating Jowers' words.
Miss Whitlock owned a restaurant out on Highland Heights on Macon Road, I believe. I believe that's where it was. Frank used to stop in there all the time. Fact is, he tried to go to bed with her all the time, Miss Whitlock. He may have, I don't know. Anyway, he'd get oiled up, get drunked up, and he'd do a lot of talking.
So what kind of talking did Frank Liberto do when he was drunked up with Lavada Addison? If we're talking about the King murder, it wasn't much. But there was one time. Here's a reading of a deposition Lavada Addison gave to Bill Pepper.
I had a TV up in the front part of the pizza parlor, and we were sitting at a table, and something came on the TV about Martin Luther King, and I don't recall what it was. But he said in a low voice to me, he said, "I had Martin Luther King killed." I said, "Don't be telling me anything like that. I don't want to hear it, and I don't believe it anyway." And I got up and walked away.
Lavada Addison ended the conversation when she walked away, but it disturbed her enough that she told her 18-year-old son Nathan about it. Nathan had his own relationship with Liberto, or Mr. Frank as he called him, a relationship he described from the witness stand at the civil trial.
Mr. Frank and myself were friends. He would come to my mother's restaurant on a daily basis. Early in the morning, late in the evening, he'd come back. I spent most of my time with him in the evening time. At the time, I had been performing in Las Vegas. And Mr. Frank, he would come in and drink beer a lot. And I knew how to play a song, an Italian song, on the guitar called Malaguena. And I used to play him this song, and he used to like this what I'd play him, and he would tip me money. And then he got to where Mr. Frank was. I had a little small three-piece combo, and he would give me jobs such as that performing.
So Mr. Frank and Nathan became friendly. But what did they talk about? That's what Bill Pepper asked at the trial.
Well, I asked him some stuff that led up to him telling me that he had came from New Orleans, but I'd heard that he was in the mafia, and I asked him if he was in the mafia. And he didn't say yes or no. He answered me, but I asked him, I said, "What is the mafia? Is it a bunch of bad guys that sit around a table and scheme up something mean to do?" And he says, "No, it's a bunch of businessmen that take care of business."
Nathan wasn't sure what to make of that, but he was upset when he learned that Liberto had bragged to his mother about the killing of King.
I went directly to Mr. Frank about it when he showed up at the pizza bar. And just asked him, I said, "Hey, man, Mr. Frank, you killed Martin Luther King?" He glared at me. He says, "You've been talking to your mother, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You wired?" I didn't even know what he meant by that. I went, "No, I'm not wired. I thought he was talking about if I'm taking amphetamine pills and wired up." I said, "No, I'm not crazy." And he sat there for a second. He says, "I don't want to offend anybody by saying this." He told me, he said, "I didn't kill the nigger, but I had it done." And I said, "Well, what about that other son of a bitch up there taking credit for it?" He says, "He wasn't nothing but a troublemaker from Missouri. He was a front man." And I didn't know what that meant. Because front man to me means something different than what he was thinking about. I said, "A what?" He said, "A setup man." I said, "Well, why'd you kill the preacher for?" He says, "Boy, you don't even need to be hearing about this anymore." He said, "Don't you say nothing." He stood up, he acted like he was going to slap me upside the head. So I stood up there, and me and him were looking at each other. And he's got this glaring look on his eye. And I could tell he was thinking about hitting me. And about that time, the phone rang, so I just walked over there and answered the phone. And I'm busy with pizza stuff, and I looked up, he's gone. And he left his beer sitting there on the table, and it's about half full.
But there was no damage done. Liberto was back the next day, and there was no further talk about King. Nathan Whitlock then told the court about something that happened at the restaurant that, for a brief moment, had Liberto and Nathan talking about something that Liberto wanted him to do.
Some guy came in, he looked kind of like John Wayne. He was a big guy, a redneck guy, walked in my mother's restaurant, drinking a beer. Mama runs over to the door, and she says, "You can't bring a beer in here, but I'll sell you one." And he says, "I might just buy this motherfucking place," and backhanded my mom. When he did, I walked around the counter with a nightstick, and I knocked fire from his tail end, knocked him through the front door, and hit him across here, busted his eye open real bad, busted his head open.
Nathan Whitlock damn near killed the guy, and would have if someone hadn't intervened. And fortunately for Nate, Liberto's friendship was enough to ensure there would be no reprisal. But more than that, what Nathan had done had made an impression on Mr. Frank. And the next time they met, Liberto started poking around, asking Nate if for money, he might consider killing a few people that needed killing.
He said, "Did you do it again?" I said, "I guess so. Somebody come up in the beach, call acting a fool, hit Mama." I said, "Yeah, I'd tear him up." And he says, "No, would you do it just in general?" I said, "To who?" He said, "Mostly dope niggers over here around Hollywood. We're going up over the vibe out there on Cloud Boulevard," and he motioned over there towards Hollywood. And I said, "Oh," he said, "could you do it for some money?" And I said, "How much money?" He said, $5 or $10, depending.
Nathan got out of the conversation without agreeing to anything. But every now and then he felt his stomach turn as he found himself thinking about it. Then, a few weeks later, the phone rang at the restaurant. It was Frank Liberto, and he asked to speak to Nathan. Liberto didn't ever call Nathan on the phone, and Nathan didn't know what this could be about, but he knew what he hoped it was not about. He said hello and heard Liberto's deep voice.
He said, "I got a job for you, Nate."
Nate felt his pulse quicken, and he's thinking,
"Oh my God, he's gonna want me to kill some dope idiot over here somewhere."
Nate kept listening, trying to understand what was being asked of him. Liberto said something about meeting down at the Civic Center and to bring his drummer friend. Suddenly, it came to him.
He was talking about a music job. We weren't talking about beating somebody up. Yeah, I'm thinking he's going to play for Sheriff Bill Morris's Christmas party.
So Nathan Whitlock played at Sheriff Morris's Christmas party, and Frank Liberto never asked him then or later to kill anybody. The next summer, Nathan went to Canada, and when he came back, his mother told him that Frank Liberto had died. So Lavada Addison and Nathan Whitlock were people who knew the real Frank Liberto. And Mr. Frank really did kind of tell them that he played a part in the killing of King. But that was years after the fact, and maybe he was just making it up. So is there someone closer to the crime who we might consult about Liberto? Turns out there is. How close to the crime was he? About a half an hour away. This man, by chance, happened to be standing near Liberto at a crucial time, and he heard a few things he was not supposed to hear.
It's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on, get ready for a ride, we're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites!
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way!
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear!
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool!
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And at that time, it wasn't five Negroes ever never been arrested for any kind of revolt. That was in the spring of 1959. And during that spring of 1959, on up until the summer, we made a great effort to get Negroes arrested and vote. And during that summer, we got a small number arrested. And on August the 12th of 1959, we had a primary election. And they refused to let us vote. The Democrat committee refused to let us vote.
That's the voice of John McFerrin, who was raised in Fayette County, Tennessee, just east of Memphis. As a young man, he served in the Army during the Second World War, and like many other black men, his time in the service had brought him to other places and shown him other things, which made him less able to accept what he had always known in Fayette County, like being denied the right to vote. As McFerrin just described, even after they'd gotten a small number of blacks to register, they were still not allowed to vote. And the reaction in the white community was swift. The White Citizens Council came up with the idea that any black person who tried to register or vote should be thrown off their land. Most black farmers were sharecroppers, so they didn't own the land they worked. And it wasn't just a threat. The evictions began.
They was making them all move. And the league got together and said, and they was coming to us, what we gonna do with all these folks that make them move off the land and they got nowhere to go. Then the group and myself come up with the idea of buying tents. And we bought maybe 30 or 40 tents from Lazo Junkyard on 3rd Street. There's army tents. And we put up the army tents. And later we named it Tent City. That's how Tent City started.
In a year's time, Tent City grew to hold over 300 people, including children, who had a canvas roof over their heads, but no income and little to eat. But that wasn't the end of it. The leaders of the group were not allowed to buy food or gasoline or much of anything else, not only in Fayette County, but in Memphis as well. John McFerrin had a small store that sold to local blacks. It was a service to the community, pretending to be a business. And suddenly, John McFerrin had access to nothing.
Wouldn't sell us no gas, wouldn't sell us no food. They didn't sell no Negroes that was called leaders. They had a list that the Ku Klux Klan and Citizen Council passed around. And the list contained names they called the troublemakers with X's behind it.
McFerrin was one of those with an X behind his name. But he did find a few sources who would sell to him on the sly, a guy with a bread truck that would meet him out on the road, and a few other people who would sell to him after hours. But then a court order came down saying that blacks had the right to vote, and a truce of sorts was called because the harsh conditions at Tent City were beginning to make Memphis look bad, and a lot of land was lying fallow. So the farmers were allowed to return, and things died back to the not very nice way they had been before. McFerrin went back to his store and was able to purchase meat at Morrell Meat Company and his vegetables from L&L Produce, a wholesale market run by Frank Liberto. And that's where he happened to be at 5:25 on the day Martin Luther King was shot. The following is from John McFerrin's testimony at the civil trial in 1999, answering questions put to him by Bill Pepper.
Would you describe what the layout of the place was and what you did when you arrived at the warehouse?
Coming in from the north side, on the right side, is a little small office. And when I got in 10 to 15 feet of this office, my latch was standing up.
James Latch was Liberto's partner and the other L in L&L Produce, and McFerrin always tried to avoid him.
Mr. Latch had a scar around his neck like this, and he'd always be in the dream, but Mr. Cueto was always friend. I would put him to Latch. I'd stay away from him if I could.
And then what happened next?
The phone rang. And when the phone rang, Latch picked it up. Latch said, "That's him again." He gave it to Mr. Cueto. And Mr. Cueto said, "Shoot it."
You can just say what he said.
"Shoot the son of a bitch on the back." Well, at that time, they didn't have noticed me. And I was just standing up a little closer to them, just looking. Then they looked around and seen me. Then they said, "Go and get your merchandise." I went on in and got my merchandise. Then, when I was coming back out, the phone rang again. Last picture up and give it to Mr. Baito. And Mr. Baito told him, go to his brother in New Orleans and get his $5,000.
At the time, McFerrin couldn't make sense out of what he had heard. But that changed quickly.
And when I got home, my wife called and said, "Do you know Dr. King who got killed?" I says, "I know it. It all come back to me in my mind what I had heard." And that's when I told her, "I know."
McFerrin couldn't forget what he heard, but it frightened him, so he didn't say anything to anyone. But the man who had been murdered was Martin Luther King, and McFerrin knew that King deserved something more from him than silence. So 2 days later, McFerrin called a white Methodist minister he knew, the Reverend Baxton Bryant, and told him that he had heard something about the King killing. He said he was afraid to go to the police and didn't know what to do. Reverend Bryant suggested that they meet the next afternoon. Before we take you to that meeting, it is important to understand who Reverend Bryant was and why McFerrin trusted him. At the time of the sanitation strike in Memphis, Reverend Bryant was the director of the Tennessee Citizens Union, a group dedicated to improving communication between the black and white communities. At that time, they weren't having much luck. This is how Reverend Bryant summed it up in an interview he gave at Rhodes College just 2 months after King was killed.
Memphis had taken a lot of pride in itself. It was paternalistic. They had made some gains, but it was racist to the core.
Racist to the core is what Bryant called it, and although he was white, he knew what that looked like. He had grown up dirt poor in rural Arkansas, one of 13 children, and like most of the blacks there, they didn't own their own land. He felt that the words of Jesus and their promise applied to everyone, black or white, and that made him a little different from a lot of the other white preachers in the Deep South. After he had moved to Memphis and became the director of the Citizens Union, Bryant played the role of go-between in the tense, stuttering negotiations between the city and the striking sanitation workers. He won the respect of both sides by not tiptoeing around. What follows is his account of a rather heated private conversation that he had with Mayor Loeb a couple of weeks before King was killed.
"I found I could say anything in this world that I wanted to the mayor and retain his friendship. I guess I appealed to him because a minister and I cuss him a little with him, you know, and he wasn't have to be the ordinary, you know, patsy of a preacher, you know, he liked it. And what he would tell me, Baxton, all I've got to give my kids is my name. My old dad taught me to be honest, and I've said I wouldn't do it. And when I give you my word, it's my word. I'm not going, but I've said I wouldn't recognize the union. I'm not going to recognize the union."
Reverend Bryant saw Loeb as hiding behind his father and his kids, and he wasn't having it.
Why can't you see, Henry, that these men, they want to be men. They don't want you to do something for them. They want to do something for themselves. Do you know what would happen if you recognized the Union? In every one of those 1,300 homes, there'd be a man sitting at the end of the table tonight. Now, this is the stuff, Henry, that you've got to have to build homes. But Daniel, so don't you sit there and tell me, you big bastard. And that's what it says to him. You big, bony, rawhide bastard. Don't look me in the eye and tell me your old dad ever told you to destroy the manhood and the guts and the integrity and the courage and wilt men down, the peons.
A couple of weeks later, Bryant attended a memorable meeting of the white ministers and black ministers at the Episcopal Church in Memphis. Bryant walked over to the meeting with the Reverend Ralph Jackson, an outspoken leader in the sanitation strike. Bryant and Jackson sat down together, and Rabbi Wax, speaking for the white ministers, started things off.
Sit down right back. And Wax got up and opened the meeting and said, I think we ought to limit this discussion to try to find out what the issues are. Ralph Jackson came unwound. Ralph jumped up and said, you tricked me. You tricked me. I fought a long laugh. My white brothers had decided to help their poor black brothers. You not only tricked me, you insult me. You insult me by saying what we're going to discuss is what the issues are. Hell, while you white bastards have sat on your ass and not done a goddamn thing, we've had 1,300 families starving. That's the issue.
Reverend Jackson walked out, but he had shaken the room, and by the end of the meeting, the ministers had decided that they would meet with Mayor Loeb as a group to see if some compromise could be reached. But it was too late. The very next day, Martin Luther King was shot and killed at the Lorraine Motel. We've taken a few moments to follow Reverend Bryant as he moved about in the racial cauldron that was Memphis, Tennessee. We did this because Bryant was the minister who John McFerrin approached when he was afraid to go to the police. And I think this choice demonstrates McFerrin's sincerity, which has constantly been challenged over the years. He didn't just go to someone. He went to a man with unquestioned moral credentials. 3 days after King was shot, John McFerrin went over to Reverend Bryant's house. This is Bryant's recollection of what McFerrin reported to him.
He was doing some shopping, buying some things, and as I understand it, walked into a place of business. And in another room, in a little office, he heard quite an angry conversation between the man on the phone and whoever he was talking to. Evidently, the person on the other end of the phone was wanting some money, and he said, you can't get your money till the job is completed. And then the statement, you can shoot the SOB on the balcony. Later in the conversation, indicated that he was not to return to this particular business to pick up the money, but that he could pick it up from his brother in New Orleans. This pretty much was the substance of the conversation.
McFerrin told Reverend Bryant that he was afraid to go to the police, that they had never been anything but nasty and threatening to him. After hearing his story, Bryant said he thought McFerrin did need to talk to the authorities, but perhaps the FBI might be the better place to start. Bryant said he would make sure that McFerrin went there with legal counsel, and he called his friend attorney David Kaywood, and that evening McFerrin and Kaywood went to see the FBI. McFerrin told them what he had heard.
I gave them the same detail they questioned me 2 or 3 hours on the same thing.
The next day, more FBI came to McFerrin's house, and they stayed for hours, asking the same questions over and over. seemingly frustrated that McFerrin's answers would not change. But along the way, something was added to the story, because a day or two after the assassination, a police sketch of the alleged assassin, who was said to be one Eric Galt, was published in the local paper. The sketch was derived from descriptions offered by a few witnesses who claimed to have seen someone fleeing the scene, a sketch that didn't look much like James Earl Ray. After seeing it, McFerrin told the FBI he thought the guy might be someone he had seen working at Liberto's the previous year. McFerrin said the guy he remembered might have been of Cuban or Mexican descent, not even close to a description of James Earl Ray. Once it was established that the police were really looking for Ray and not some guy named Galt, and they had an actual photo to work with, they returned to question McFerrin. The Department of Justice report, released in June of 2000, tells us what happened. Now quoting. The FBI showed him an array of six photographs which included Ray's picture. McFerrin excluded Ray and instead tentatively identified three others who did not resemble Ray as the man who had worked for Liberto. In any normal police lineup using photos, McFerrin's exclusion of the photo of Ray had to mean that the man McFerrin was remembering was not James Earl Ray or someone who looked like him. Case closed. Beyond that, it's not exactly clear how McFerrin could be said to be claiming that three different men could be the man who worked for Liberto. Best guess was that McFerrin said these three were the ones who most resembled the guy. How else do you make sense of that sentence? So McFerrin remembered some guy who worked for Liberto who shared some likeness to the police sketch of the missing assassin. And the guy was certainly not James Earl Ray. Nevertheless, this whole six-photo game of whack-a-mole would be termed McFerrin's misidentification, and it would become the easy shorthand way to dismiss McFerrin's story, which has been done ever since. With McFerrin, there are basically three possibilities. Either he's telling the truth, or he made up the story, or he was somehow mistaken. I think because of who he was and that he sought out Reverend Bryant to tell what he heard, it is safe to say that McFerrin had not invented his story. Is it possible that he didn't hear what he thought he heard? Yes, it is possible. But shoot the son of the bitch on the balcony and get your money from my brother in New Orleans. These are rather memorable declarations. Nevertheless, the FBI came to a quick determination that McFerrin was not to be believed. What did Reverend Bryant think about that?
Last Wednesday morning, the FBI told me they didn't believe this story related in any way to the King's assassin, and they were through with it.
So what's your reaction to this? How do you feel about this?
Well, of course, I'm no detective and don't try to be one, but I wasn't satisfied with it. Doesn't make sense to me that the man in the completeness of the story, I've heard him tell it a number of times, he doesn't vary in the story, and there are other elements in it that... my mind is not at peace at all, that there's not something here that needs to be, someone needs to take a deeper look at.
So the FBI told Reverend Bryant that McFerrin's story had nothing at all to do with the killing of King. What a strange thing to say. From that, I suppose we may presume that someone else was to be shot on the balcony. But it didn't much matter, because after Ray was captured and the lone assassin story took hold, nobody much cared about what a black store owner thought he heard. So is there anyone else who can tell us about Frank Liberto? Was he really just a produce guy?
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip! The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places!
Click, click, put your seatbelts on, get ready for a ride, we're gonna have some fun!
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites!
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
The They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear.
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What was the role of Frank Liberto?
You know, man, I don't know. Just rumors are like buttholes. Everybody's got one.
What we want. Yeah.
The old man was good to me. He set me up in the cocaine business. I mean, he just gave me the melons and fronted me the dope.
This is Ronnie Lee Atkins remembering how Frank Liberto helped him start a business on a street corner in Memphis, and how a judge who was friendly with his father was quite certain that Ronnie Lee, sometimes called Bear, wasn't out there selling dope.
Well, I had it. I wedged them out and put the baggies full of coke in there, and we had watermelons for $7, and then we had watermelons for $200. And out at the corner of Summer and Perkins. And so I'm selling these melons, and this snitch comes by, and I sell him some melons, and he goes, calls the law. And so I go in this big store to get Sherry and me a drink. And when I started back out the door, I looked, the tax squad done hit Sherry. Well, they had her with her legs wrapped around the front tire and her arms wrapped around the front tire and was holding a shotgun on her going, where's Bear? And she's going, I don't know, I ain't seen that son of a bitch. And she turned and she's looking at me coming out. And so I just cut and went through the alley and went on and went. And matter of fact, I went to the little house and climbed on top of it there on 4514 Warden Road. And I just laid there until the heat was off. They just carried Sherry to jail, you know. I told Mama call the bondsman and she called, and Blue Baron and Tyrone ended up calling the judge, and he said, Bear's our lady, and we'll let her out. Hell, we'll take care of this later on. You know, that boy ain't out there selling dope.
At this telling, these memories were decades old. It had been more than 40 years since King's assassination when Ronnie Lee Atkins came from Texas back to Memphis to testify about what he knew of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King. And Atkins knew a lot, because as he would reveal, his entire family, his father, mother, older brother, and Ron himself, played active roles in the killing of King. His father, Russell Atkins Sr., was in charge of heavy equipment for the Memphis Department of Public Works, but his far-reaching power came from his unique position in the community. He was a 32nd degree Mason, active in the Klan, and the unofficial head of the pervasive crime spree in Memphis, sometimes known as the Dixie Mafia. He had helped install Henry Loeb as mayor, brought in former FBI area director Frank Holloman as the head of police and fire, and if that were not enough, he had a personal friendship with Clyde Tolson, Hoover's number two at the FBI. If anyone in Memphis needed to get something done, Russell Atkins was the one to see. And for the 10 years leading up to the murder of King, Ronnie Lee Atkins had a front row seat for it all.
I was born in 52, and in 60, I started getting privy to a lot of business. Of course, I couldn't open my pie hole and say anything, you know, but I was able to sit and listen. My job was to bring the coffee and the donuts. If the cornbread and buttermilk was ready, I'd go in there and get it and bring it out to them. If the ham and the greens was ready, they'd put it on plates, and the women folk, and I'd carry it out to the little house. And then I'd run down and get the coffee. And, you know, I learned how to run a percolator probably when I was 3 or 4 years old. I don't know.
Atkins was giving this testimony in 2009 by way of a deposition that would be legally attached to the court proceedings brought by Coretta Scott King a decade earlier. In the room that looked out at Memphis from the 20th floor was Atkins lawyer Stephen Tolan, court reporter Brian Dominski, and Bill Pepper, the attorney for Mrs. King, all appropriately dressed for the occasion. In their presence, with his headscarf, white beard, and t-shirt tightly fit on a full body, Atkins looked like a good-natured, well-fed biker. Pepper would ask the questions this day, and Atkins would answer.
You went to high school here in Memphis?
To several high schools.
You went to several high schools?
I went to 10 schools in, I don't know, 10 or 12 years.
Ah, okay. So you had problems in the schools?
No, sir. I just liked to fight.
I see.
Well, no problems. You know, I chased girls and, you know.
Did you graduate from high school?
No, sir.
You dropped out of the school?
I went back to school. I was playing football over at Kingsbury, and I went back, and Coach Brock, he told me to get out and run some laps and stuff, and I didn't run like, you know, he wanted me to run. I wasn't studying running. You know, the old man done died, and, you know, so anyway, he told me, he said, catch hold. And when I got up in there, I had my little shorts on, my little tennis and all that, and I bent over, and, you know, he whooped my ass one of them boards with them holes in them, and cut me pretty good, and I asked him if he was done. He said, yeah. I said, it's the last time he'll do that. And I went home. Next day, I come back with a pistol. And him and the high school principal, Mr. Billingsley, was down there by the chow hall. And so I come in the front door, and I had Daddy's little old Derringer in my pocket with a handful of shells. And I got off about four good shots and cleared the hall, knocked a couple holes in the ceiling. And then they jumped me, and I ended up down at juvenile court.
Ronnie Lee Atkins had an unusual upbringing. Because he was the son of Russell Atkins, he got to sit at an early age in the back of the room during Mason and Klan meetings, some of which were held in his father's house and others that were held at the nearby Baptist church. When the rallies were held upstairs at the church, they were referred to as prayer meetings.
Can you discuss your dad and his associates and their relationship with the Klan? Were they active Klan members?
Yes,
and they were active. They were active Klan members.
As long as I can remember, yes, sir.
Was it a particular chapter of the Klan, or was it invisible, was it Tennessee? Was it
Invisible Empire?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
And did they have regular Klan meetings?
Yes, sir.
Were you ever allowed to attend any of those meetings?
Yes, sir. They called them rallies, is what they call them, you know, or prayer meeting. We're going to prayer meeting. You know, I mean, they'd sit around, and, you know, now I was a kid now. I was taking all this in, and you know, when you're a kid, you're pretty gullible, or at least I was. I mean, I everybody else might not be. I was pretty gullible.
With the Klan members, your father and other Klan members, were they also Masons?
Yes, sir.
Were they all Masons?
I don't know, Don. I'd say the majority of them were.
They were members of, and which lodge did they belong to?
Summer Avenue Lodge.
How far did your father go in the right?
32nd.
He went to the 32nd?
Yes, sir. And both my grandfathers.
The Freemasons, or Masons, are a secret society that date back to the stonemasons who built the great cathedrals in Europe. In the 18th and 19th century, men of stature might be secret members of the Masons and be guided by high moral principles. George Washington, for example. For most of their history, the Masons were opposed by the Catholic Church, and an anti-Catholic bias was surely present in the Memphis Masons in the 1960s. To be a 32nd degree Mason meant that you were at the very top of this men-only society. The meetings were highly ritualized, with symbols and code, but an outsider might regard them as simply as an excuse for men to gather, drink, and engage in hocus-pocus. But as Ronnie Lee would explain, the Klan and the Masons, while sharing some members, were not the same.
Let me tell you how this Klan and Masonic deal works. let's say we got some timber we want to cut. Well, if you just don't care about your land, you're going to send the Klan in there and say, I want this timber cut out, clear out just 2 acres. Well, they ain't going to leave nothing standing. They're going to cut whatever they're going to cut, and they're going to get it out, and then they're going to burn the rest of it. With the Masonics, well, they'd go in there and they'd measure the timber, and they'd size it up, and then they'd take out selected groups and they'd drag them out, and then they'd leave the rest going and grow and harvest so that they could return later to get some more timber. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where with the Klan, that was more like a pit bulldog that's just aggravated, as to the Masonics would be more like a German Shepherd that had been raised halfway decent and a good command of.
How did they interact with organized crime in this whole region? How did
they were organized crime. The whole bunch was organized crime. If you call them organized.
But if you're dealing with Klansmen who are Masons.
Yes, sir.
And then you're starting to get into ethnic organized crime with Carlos Marcello.
Right.
You know, the Libertos and people like that.
Right.
They're Italians, obviously.
Daddy called them WOPs.
Yeah.
But you know, Frank was in some of them meetings up there, so, Lamberto, so, Marcellus came up for meetings, but hell, so did Clyde Tolson.
Carlos Marcello was the powerful mafia boss from New Orleans, and Clyde Tolson was the number two man at the FBI, who we will talk about later. We can't know if they were ever present at the same time, but it's a charming thought to imagine them sitting together at a so-called prayer meeting at the Baptist church where nasty, illegal things are being planned. So Memphis guys, when they were just by themselves, didn't like Italians and didn't like Catholics. But they were fine doing business with them if there was something in it for everyone. When we think about organized crime, we might think about such things as the Lufthansa heist at JFK and other big-ticket scores. But in the South in the 50s and 60s, times were tough and piles of money weren't just laying around to be stolen. So organized crime existed by creating small streams of income, but many of them. A small gambling operation would pass money up. Same with prostitution or drugs.
I went to McKellar Lake with Chess Butler. And we got to the boat that we kept down there. It was filled with marijuana that came up Mississippi River from New Orleans. And I know that came in from Marcellus because that was a direct deal that came through Daddy, but Chess handled that for Daddy. Daddy didn't get around that boat.
And Chess Butler handled other things for Russell Sr.
And I have seen Chess do some crazy stuff. You know, I mean, I've seen him stab a guy. I don't know whether the guy died or not. Because Daddy sent him over because a man owed him some money over doing something, and the guy didn't do it and kept the money. I seen him take an ice pick to a man out there at Rubilio's one night because Daddy sent him outside with it and give him the ice pick to do it.
So with that charming image, we are going to move forward in time. Ronnie Lee is 13 or 14, but on occasion he still carries coffee to some of the meetings. And he just sits in on others and no one cares because he's always been there. But in 1965 and 66, Ronnie Lee notices a change in the talk about killing King. It starts to become specific.
I mean, they just started doing some planning, you know. They just started putting it together. The main thing was, I remember Daddy was talking to Sam Chambers and Henry Loeb at the house. Now, this took place in a garage. I was carrying coffee out to them. And I ended up going up, and Graham gave me the percolator and a can of Maxwell House coffee. And I remember that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun thing, you know, and that was on TV. And she said, here, take this out there. They were talking about how they were going to disrupt the city. The plan was to disrupt the city because they was going to get King to the city because Tolson said that they wanted it handled in Memphis where Daddy and them could handle it, where specifically Daddy and them could handle it.
The actual crisis that brought King to Memphis, the sanitation strike, would come after Russell Atkins had died and Tolson had been set back by a stroke. But the plan was the same. Get King to come to the city and find a way to have him killed.
And then you had a crisis where the one or two sanitation workers were killed.
No, there was two of them.
In the truck itself?
They squashed them in the truck.
How did that happen? Do you know how that happened?
Somebody pulled a hammer on the, pulled the lever on the truck and mashed them up in there, and they were up in there trying to get out of the rain is what they was doing.
And somebody, was it Jim Ryan?
No, I think it was Holly.
You think it was Holly?
I think it was.
Pulled the hammer and killed them deliberately?
He knew they was in there when he did it.
He knew. And why did he do it?
He didn't tell me, Pepper. I don't know. You asked me a $64 question. Yeah. Was it black? Was it part of the guys causing the trouble?
What I'm saying was it something they were trying to do to create more tension in order to bring Martin King in?
You know, I believe so. We've all talked about that. You know, we think that was the ticket that absolutely brought him in. It caused his death. Because that's when Frank said, we got to get on with this. You know, we got to get on with it.
Frank Holloman?
Yes, sir.
At this point, Ronnie Lee Atkins was not only hearing things about disrupting the city to bring King to Memphis, he was also doing things. By his own admission, rather nasty things.
All right, now, we're into 1968. The sanitation workers' strike hits.
Yes, sir. Dead is dead.
Who's taken over the...
Russell Jr. and Holloman.
So Russell Jr. and Frank Holloman are running... the assassination effort.
Yes, sir.
What was done, to the best of your knowledge, was done to provoke the sanitation workers' strike and the anger to the level that it rose, where it became a very serious, crippling strike in Memphis?
Henry Loeb.
Now, explain what Loeb, you believe Loeb did.
I know what Loeb did. Henry's reaction to it was, go burn this down and go burn that down, and that's what we did.
So you mean that the mayor set you about the business of creating...
The word was arson.
Creating, of committing arson.
Yes.
And this was sanctioned by the mayor?
No, he just told us to go do it.
Yeah.
Ronnie Lee Atkins was only 16 when Dr. King was shot. He witnessed the murder, he played a role in it, he knew others who were involved, and we will hear him talk about these things in a future episode. But we will end this segment with Ronnie Lee's answer to a question from Bill Pepper.
Now, in retrospect, looking back, how do you see the role of your father in all of this?
I think Daddy was just Daddy. I think he was real low-key. I think he had a job and a couple of businesses. And I think this was something that came down on him and from on high. And some old boys asked him to take care of something, and he was obligated to take care of it. That's what I believe. I don't think my daddy took a dime from the government to do this work. I'm talking about, here's $5,000, go kill this guy, or take care of this, or go move this from here to there. I don't think that ever happened. It was more of a bartering. We're living in the South. We've got a problem down here. I've got men that wants to work. Y'all trying to give all the jobs to the coloreds. And I've got some white boys over here that need some jobs. I've heard Daddy say nigger, and I've heard him say coon, and I've heard him say porch monkey, and I've heard him say spook, and I've heard my daddy say some, pretty horrific stuff. But you know what? I've said the same thing. It's all I knew at the time, and then, in 2000, got educated a little bit. So, and I started changing my life, and that's what helped bring us here today. I mean, it's about me turning around.
Next time on the MLK Tapes.
After several hours of questioning and cross-examining Ray, told him that there was no such person as Raoul, and he knew there was no such person as Raoul. He admitted that and told me that he had to invent Raoul because that's what Huey wanted.
We met with Glenda Grabo and Roy Grabo. She first said, almost their opening statement was, we know a Raoul, but we don't know if it's the Raoul that you're looking for.
This story was so extraordinary that
that when I first heard it, I have to say that I was profoundly skeptical. There was only parts of the story that I could get corroboration on.
That all white people's going to thank Ray someday for being sacrificed.
That all white people are going to thank Ray someday for being...
for being the sacrifice for us.
Jack kind of bluffed and whipped out his BBC credentials and told him he was making a movie, and they gave him the information, so we had the name.
Thanks for listening to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. This podcast is not specifically endorsed by the King family or the King Estate. The MLK Tapes is written and hosted by Bill Klaber. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on behalf of iHeartRadio, with producers Trevor Young and Ben Kiebrick. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV, with producers Jamie Albright and Meredith Stedman. Original music by Makeup and Vanity Set. Cover art by Mr. Soul 216, with photography by Artemis Jenkins. Special thanks to Owen Rosenbaum and Grace Royer at UTA, The Nord Group, Beck Media and Marketing, Envision Business Management, and Station 16. If you have questions, you can visit our website, themlktapes.com. We posted photos and videos related to the podcast on our social media accounts. You can check them out at themlktapes. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.